This episode is sponsored by GoToMeeting.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets are down for 5 weeks in a row. Economics are dismal. Greece is on the edge. And joining us today are guests Frank Curzio and Terry Bedford. All this and more on episode number 215 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the beginning of June 2011. Well, howdy and welcome. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 215. Is Andrew Horowitz, and we have pretty much an action-packed show today that's going to have a lot of good information. We have Frank Curzio is going to come up first. We're going to get him all dialed in, and then Terry Bedford. I can't wait to hear some of the things that he has to say about this market and the conditions. But before we get to that, I had a few things that I wanted to talk about. First of all, I just want to mention that we are sponsored by GoToMeeting. And if you haven't checked out GoToMeeting, you need to do so. You get 30 days for free, absolutely for free. You get all the bells and whistles, and it's a great system to check out because you get to have online meetings, collaboration. You can do like I do with my son is we share a textbook online and do test prep. Really great stuff. I love it. Go check out the GoToMeeting free offer by going to GoToMeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button and enter the promo code PODCAST. GoToMeeting.com and promo code PODCAST. Check that out. I think you'll enjoy that. Let's get to a few things that I think are more than interesting. I mean, wow. One of the things I've been getting a lot of notes in on, a lot of emails from you, is the whole discussion about silver. We've talked about it several times the last couple of months, and I wanted to give you a quick update. First of all, if you haven't done so, I put a new analysis, a very detailed analysis of what to expect from the prices of silver. That went up this week, and you could just go over to the disciplinedinvestor.com and check it out. I think the most important thing to recognize here is that it has an eerie similarity to what happened back in the 80s with the Hunt brothers. And I think really what we're dealing with now is that you have a double whammy. On one hand, you have the issue that it is a metal that people want to own in the event of a cataclysmic economic disaster, sovereign debt default, etc. On the other hand, everybody's touting it as an industrial metal. Well, the problem is if you have an economic slowdown, industrial metals are less used. So that's number one. Number two, probably more important is going by the technicals and some of the commitment of traders that we've seen. There's two things happening right now. First of all, the price of silver, the commodity, is hanging around very nicely around about its 100-day moving average. Keeps on popping up to that. And that's on the incline. The second thing is that there are a couple of Fibonacci numbers that is right on as well. It is a make it or break it time, but right now, we're probably going to see, as I mentioned, a little bit of a move higher temporarily because the commitment of traders report shows a very big movement to the short side. Now, what does that mean? That means that when you see that kind of a ratio of shorts to longs, and again, this chart is on the website that I mentioned on our website, what you see is a kind of a contrary trade happen because the shorts get squeezed when they get a little bit too overzealous, and the same thing happens when people get too greedy on the bullish side. And right now, there's a lot of shorts that would have to cover if the price does come up at all, and there's been some pretty good price support right at these levels. So the conclusion, I'll take it to the end, is that you may want to look into not really long, but at certain levels, and we list those in that discussion, you may want to consider moving to a short position, whether you short SLV or buy ZSL, or you go out and get the commodity itself, or maybe do an option. For example, you can pick up an option on the 32s, 34s on SLV or on the commodity. So those are a couple of things that I want to make you aware of. The second thing is that we broke some key levels in the markets. We broke the 50, the 100-day moving average. We broke trend support on all indices. Is the S&P 500, the Russell 2000, the Dow, and the NASDAQ. Probably the most interesting thing that didn't happen on Thursday and Friday of last week was a spike in volume. Now, there's a lot of reasons why that can happen. You know, we saw that on the way up, and everybody said, oh, volume doesn't matter. You know, on the way down, of course, everybody's yapping about how volume matters and how when things go down, you have to have good volume. I believe both are true. You have to have good volume on either side to see conviction. Markets naturally have a proclivity to move up over time, just over time. So that you have to put into the equation. On the other hand, when you see a sell-off, you want to note how much conviction's involved in it. We didn't see a lot of that on Friday, but yet markets really did sell off and there was a lot of damage, even though a lot of leading and quality stocks didn't do badly at all. But if you notice that the leadership has still been very defensive, financials have not really done well, materials are getting squashed, energies are getting hurt. And I think that you need to pay attention to this because it is clearly not only the rotation, but it's a signal that a lot of the, as we call it, the big boys, are getting very defensive. So I think that you have to look at this, and 1,300 is a key level. We tested that on Friday on the S&P. It popped up just ever so slightly at the end. And that is a, I don't want to say it's a good sign, but it is a sign that at least there is some buying, that there is some support levels that are finding key. If we do break through that 1,300, it looks like 1,275 and 1,240 are the next targets. Russell is broken down. The NASDAQ is broken down. And obviously, we may see a pop here or there, and it may turn around from here. But what we're doing is we have our core positions that we like. If they start fading against us and moving down past support points, we are carving those back and peeling those back, but getting them ready when they do create a proper buy point again. In the meantime, we're hedging the portfolio utilizing inverse ETFs so that, for example, if we have, as an example, 50% long invested of individual equities, et cetera, we may have a 50% hedge against that. Now, why would you do that? Well, in theory, the stocks that we own should perform well. In theory, maybe they won't, but just this is the theory of it. And what you want to do is you hedge it out against market action. Now, in any market that is significantly down, I don't care how good the stock is, unless you're Netflix, you're going to be down. Have you seen Netflix lately? It just doesn't seem to want to go down, ever, no matter what. So I think that you have to look at this market right now as in a corrective stage due to the circumstances of really bad economics around the world, a lot of tension with what's going on in Europe. And I'll tell you something, you want to talk about liars and damn liars? You know, Greece didn't need a bailout, then they did. They got the bailout, they were going to do austerity measures and meet their targets. They didn't. Now they only needed about $75 billion because they couldn't go to market to get any money. Wait! Now they need closer to $150 billion 2 days later. So I think this whole sham that's going on in Europe is only to postpone the inevitable and hopefully buy some time so that in the period that they have this time that they're buying, they will be able to figure out a solution. But so far we've noted that a year and change later, there is no solution, even with all the incredible amounts of money they put into it. And the same thing is happening here. The dual mandate of the Fed is being met on the low inflation front, depending on how you look at inflation. But the employment numbers we saw on Friday and the declining and the downward movement of the employment situation over the last 4 or 5 weeks has been pretty significant. Even though a lot of analysts said that there was going to be no material impact on the world economy and growth because of the Japanese tsunami, we're feeling a lot of it now because of the supply chain disruptions, as well as just all the things that have gone on recently with the higher oil prices and Europe. But the final thing I want to mention to you, and then we'll get to our guests, is that, you know, I tell you, I'm a little bit disappointed at something, and maybe you could tell me if I'm wrong here, but, you know, each time we see an employment number come out and it's really good, you got President Obama and the gang and Goolsbee, you know, get on there and talk about how great the plan is working and all things are great with employment. And we get a pretty ugly number here, well below expectations, and there's nothing even mentioned of significance about how it's so awful. So I think there's a little bit of, it's kind of disingenuous to start only talking about that when things are, you know, going in the direction that they want them to. And I understand why. You want to make sure you hold confidence high, but at the same time, you have to wonder, you know, what is this all about? Last thing, and then we'll get to this, is I want you to take a look at a stock called Verifone, Pay, P-A-Y. I spent some time studying the company, looking at the earnings, as well as listening very closely to the conference call. We own that for our clients, for Horowitz Company clients, in the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. But interesting where they have the near-field communications, where they'll be able to do the payment systems through the cell phones and smartphones. And I think that the overall market for that is going to be enormous in a number of years. They recently fell out of bed because of a DOJ blockage of the Hyperion deal, because it was going to create some antitrust issues. But I think they're going to get beyond that. And they've been very acquisitive. And the company looks like they're going to have some interesting results with their taxi business and their petroleum business. So just take a look at those, that stock. Tell me what you think. Obviously, do your research first. It's not a recommendation. It's just something we think is interesting. All right. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we have two great guests today. And we're going to start with my good friend, Frank Curzio, because there's a lot of things we need to talk about with regard to the economic environment and how that's going to really play out. So, Frank, what's going on?
Wow, how's it going out there?
It's going great. And I know things are good with you. I talked with you last week and you told me how much you were really enjoying, you know, Florida and the nice weather and all those beautiful things. Just wait another. Have you lived here in the summer yet?
Yes, I lived here in the summer. It's pretty crazy. But I do have air conditioner. I do have a pool, so it helps out.
You have an air conditioner?
Yeah, absolutely.
How cool is that? Wow.
You know, it's funny when people say, oh, you know, it gets so hot in Florida. Well, if you're going to stand out in the middle of a park when it's right. 110 degrees, it's going to get hot. But if you have a pool and you're in air conditioned weather, it's really not too bad.
You know what I do? First of all, it's like when people say that to me real quick is I say, you know what? You know, it's cold in New York and in Canada in the winter, but I don't stand outside all the time. I go inside the heat. And the second thing is, let me just explain what I do during the summer. In the summertime, I go in my pool and I pretend I'm a hippopotamus. I just sit there and kind of splash water over my back, you know what I'm saying, in the pool, mm-hmm. and float around and then go down and all that. And just, you know, I'm the hippo. It's my hippopotamus summer.
Yeah, it does get very, very hot in a couple months. But you know what? The last 2 to 3 months have been absolutely fantastic. Oh, where, yeah. You know, 65 degrees at night and 80, 85 during the day, which is perfect.
I have a very smooth segue from the horrible to the horribleness of it. We have the beautiful weather here over in Florida, and we have the storm and nightmare about the global economic condition that I want to start out and talk to you about. Because you and I, we look at things in a similar way in one regard, in that we look at the top-down macroeconomic circumstance around the world. And that obviously plays a big part in what happens to companies and earnings and things of that nature. But also, we look at the bottoms up and see how a company's doing, because you could always fight the trend if something is really spectacular. But over the last, let's say in 2011, let's just go back to 2011. It appears to me that there's been a tremendous amount of ignoring any of the bad news from the Middle East and North Africa situation. We got, you know, a blip down, and then, oh, no big deal, because everybody was saying it's not going to affect anything. $100 oil is not going to affect economics. Then we had, of course, the ongoing European saga. And then on top of that, we had the Japan earthquake, which, what you get, once again, by the way, economists said, not going to affect global growth. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
And you and I said, are you kidding? Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to affect sooner or later. It may not be now. Let's now fast forward and talk about, I'm going to give you a list of things here. And I want you to talk to me a little bit about that. I went back into May, and I looked at things like the durable goods orders, -3.6 when the survey was -2.5. Capital order ships, -2.6 versus -2.1. The prior on those were all positive. So what is that kind of telling you right now about our, you know, the big issue about manufacturing and goods?
Well, I could tell you that it's not only manufacturing and goods. I mean, you're looking at industrial production, ADP, consumer confidence, the manufacturing stuff you just mentioned. I mean, almost every economic data point, especially over the last 2 months, have been incredibly weak, mm-hmm. outright terrible. So I'm going to say something, but the Friday's unemployment number, which came in at 54,000, and we spoke about after that came out, I wasn't too surprised. A lot of people surprised, and I've been writing about it because we were looking 12 months ago at economists telling us this economy was going to grow 4% based on QE2.
Right.
We grew at 1.8, 1.7. It looks like our economy is going to grow more like 2%. And these estimates are still inflated. They're being drastically lowered from 4% to 3%. I cannot see how we're going to get to 3%. I just don't see it. And if we don't, that's going to translate into a slower economy. So therefore, stocks aren't as cheap as everyone's saying out there based on the macro picture, in my opinion.
Yeah. So one of the things that I find super interesting is the whole idea that, first of all, when I come back in life, I want to be, there's a couple things I want to be, aside from being you, of course, Frank.
Of course.
Yeah, I want to be, well, either my children, of course, or I want to be an economist, because an economist, a straight-up paid economist for the work they do, hardly is ever wrong, because they get to adjust and reapply and then look at the instrument. You know, one of the things that we saw this week, moving into the NFP number on Friday, was that we saw the ADP number come out Wednesday, which was a shock just looking at it because of how off that was initially. But then all of a sudden, the economists get to rework their numbers. Goldman came down to 100. This one came down to, I mean, there's only like one or two that were in the, I think, 60 or 70 range. Now, when it comes to economists and it comes to analysts, what they do is usually overshoot, right? Either side.
Absolutely.
Very rarely are the other. Either too optimistic, which causes all sorts of grief in the markets and in the economy and in the general financial world, or they're extremely weak or to the low side, which is always viewed as a real positive situation. So right now, what do you think is the big effect, and why are we seeing such a dramatic drag on the jobs number when, you know, it looked like there was some growth going on? You know, what's the factor? What's causing all this?
Well, a few things. One is that if for the people listening out there who do own small businesses, there's really no incentive for you to hire. I mean, productivity, you're able to get more out of your workers. If you do hire more people, you have to pay more in healthcare costs. I mean, it's better to pay these people overtime. But all the small businesses that I talk to are not really hiring. Actually, they shrunk their staffs, and they're able to increase productivity more than they ever thought they would over the past 3-year period. So if you're looking at businesses right now, there's just no incentive to hire. I mean, if you're looking on that type of a landscape, but I just don't see the hiring continue going forward. There's too much difficulty forecasting into the future. I mean, you're talking about economists, and I would say anyone listening to your podcast right now, which is a fantastic podcast, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
They have a much better perspective on what's going on in the economy. I mean, these economists are multimillionaires. They hang out with multimillionaires. To them, the economy is absolutely perfect. They just look at data, and they don't go out in the real world. They don't talk to policemen, firemen. They don't see teachers getting laid off. They don't understand the cost of everything that they pay for are rising, because it really doesn't matter to them. Seriously, every single economist that presents these figures are millionaires, multimillionaires. So when you're looking at the economy, and sometimes that macro data, it gets a little crazy, maybe confusing. It's all about buying things that are more expensive, looking at the houses across the street, how many are for sale now, which are a ton. The housing market's going down. The housing values are going down. And when you see this, I don't know why it's such a surprise that we're seeing negative economic data at this point. I really don't.
Well, and also, I think that when you look at the economists, and as you describe them, they have a similar distinction to the crowds they hang out in and their viewpoints to politicians, who are obviously just as out of sync, because the politicians listen to the economists. And it's kind of like, you know, the two fat guys standing next to each other going, "Hey, you look pretty thin there, buddy." You know,
yeah, absolutely. You know? I mean, and the politicians are just listening to polls. You know, that's all it is. Right. I mean, they're looking to get hired again, which is why, I mean, we have entitlement programs where every single person in this world agrees that they're going to bankrupt this country, but we won't do anything about them. Why? No. Because nobody wants to. Right. It's huge. If a politician goes out there and says they want to cut Medicaid, Medicare, they're not going to get reelected. So, you know, it's a very difficult scenario out there. We know something's going to be done, but the people that have to get it done are not going to do it. But yeah, it's going to come to a time and a point in time that we have to cut these. I mean, we have to. We don't have a choice. Right. So we'll see how that goes going forward.
The biggest, I think, concern also has been the Case-Shiller number that we saw this week. Aside from the very much conflicting consumer confidence numbers between both the University of Michigan, that came out relatively okay, and the Conference Board's numbers, which were just horrible. But the Case-Shiller numbers came out, and that's the 20-city month-over-month and the annualized year-over-year number. And right now, the Case-Shiller number, if you own a home and you said, okay, the high of it was X back in 2007, 2008, 2009, so wherever that exact time period was that your house was at its high, right now, on average, it's at the lowest point since that time. So the argument for QE2, which was to stabilize the housing market, to help unemployment, and to create a non-inflationary market. Let's look at that. No inflation and employment. That's the two specific mandates.
Yeah, more specifically, they gave basically the money filters into banks and they're supposed to lend it out, and the banks aren't lending it out.
Right. So, but let's look at those two points. How would you grade QE2, QE1, QE2 on the points of employment and on the point of keeping inflation in check?
Well, I have to say the simple answer would be an F. You know, everyone would say, oh, QE2 didn't work. And, you know, it didn't work for the point where economic data is getting weak and they expected it to get better. Since we released QE2, I don't think we've seen any job growth since the QE2 was released, especially the numbers that they were anticipating. However, QE2 did help push stocks much, much higher. So, you know, I wouldn't give it an F. I'd probably give it like a C-. But, you know, remember, when we release these things, you know, and everybody's going to tell you how it didn't work. But yeah, when you're looking at stocks and equities, and a lot of people own equities out there, the reason why the market's going up because we're seeing interest rates at zero. I mean, stocks remain one of the best asset classes. I won't go out there and say, you know, they're the best asset class and stocks are cheap and you have to buy. That's just simply not the case. There's values out there. But I think it's misleading saying stocks are the best asset class because, you know, we just saw the market get crushed over the past month or so. And you know, it turned out they weren't the best asset class. You would have been better off being in cash. So yeah, yeah. I think, you know, you have to be careful what you hear on TV sometimes. But I would probably grade it a C- to answer your question.
All right. So, but what I think is really fascinating, this may be, let's just break this down into, you know, a lunch pail discussion and two beers. Here it is. Close to $1 trillion between the total quantitative easing package was utilized. Let's not even add any stimulus or unemployment benefits. By the way, President Obama is trying to push another extension to the unemployment benefits as a precursor or a pre-requirement to another bill they're trying to pass on immigration laws. I believe it's immigration laws. He's trying to say, you know, or there's a whole thing going on there. So the bottom line on that is that I find it very interesting that when you look at the you know, what is going to be done, this looking already for, you know, more spending and stimulus. But when you look at the $1 trillion, I think that breaks down to about $850,000 per job created from QE. Frank, how about they just give everybody, every man, woman, child in America, I don't care if you're an immigrant or not, or a citizen or not, $50,000 last year. Don't you think that would have done a better job?
It might have done a better job in hindsight. I mean, you know, we have to realize where we came from. I mean, we came from one of the, you know, the worst recessions in almost every one of our lifetimes. And we've come out of it unbelievably quicker than anyone ever imagined. And I think, and that's because of all the money being spent on the economy by the government. Eventually that faucet has to be turned off. And when it does, it's going to be painful. It's just a matter of, hey, you know what? Is it going to be QE3 and then, okay, stocks go up a little bit more? Or is enough enough? We're going to see the economy growing at 2%. We're going to get used to unemployment rate at over 8%, 9%. I mean, even maybe over 10%. So it depends how much stimulus is going into the economy. Right now, there's just I don't see the hiring continue. I see a weaker economy. Could that change? Yes, it could change. But right now, based on the data that we've seen over the past couple months and based on the economic landscape where we're seeing home prices go down, foreclosure rates are going to go higher. That could filter right back down to bank balance sheets where they have to take more write-downs. And that's why you're seeing the banks drastically underperform the market here. But I remain a little nervous here on the markets until I see something that tells me otherwise. And hopefully we do, because I know a lot of people listen to this podcast own stocks. I manage small cap stocks. Listen, I hope I'm wrong. I hope the market goes up higher. I just don't see it based on the data I'm looking at.
Yeah, and the small caps, which is really interesting. I find this kind of fascinating about the small caps. Russell 2000 in particular. There has been, if I can count this, there's been like three major head fakes on the Russell numbers. I mean, they hit an all-time high. Came down sharply, bounced right back, came down sharply. I think they bounced back again, and then they came down sharply. You know, the Russell will obviously run ahead of most because the small caps are much more volatile, et cetera. But the interest rate environment should still be very beneficial for them, and the dollar situation should be very beneficial. But nonetheless, they are stocks, and as we know, when a market is correcting in a process of either short-term or long-term correction, you know, stocks get hit. I don't care who you are, how great it is.
Yeah,
that's just the way it is.
And it has been very beneficial to them. So, I mean, they're outperforming the large caps by 50% since the lows. Of course, if you look before that, small caps got hit even worse, but the gap has been widening. So small caps have been outperforming large caps, especially since November, the last like 6-7 months, to the point where now they're more expensive compared to large caps than any time in more than 30 years. So that tells you where small caps have come. So yes, it's definitely been beneficial, but it does get to a point where, okay, enough's enough, where they've gotten to levels where, you know, they're extremely expensive, and you know, you're looking for a pullback. And a lot of small caps have really pulled back over the past month, which people don't talk about, where, you know, you're looking at maybe, you know, a 5% decline on the Russell, but some of these stocks get nailed 20-30% in a blink of an eye on no news. And you look at it, which is good for me because I can go out and purchase some of these stocks for a newsletter. But it's pretty crazy, the small cap market, especially over the past month.
All right, let me throw you a curveball here. Now, don't get upset.
Yeah.
No, not you. Anybody listening. I think the higher unemployment numbers are good for stocks.
Why is that?
Well, let's just let me say this a little differently. I think the higher initial claims that I see, because that's a much more closely, you know, it's a weekly deal, is showing me that companies are very busy laying off, because I think it's not necessarily due to demand, necessarily. I think it has to do with the margin squeeze issue. Every conference call that I've been listening to has been, and I'm sure you've been listening to as well, mm-hmm. I've been very concerned about the idea that there is a margin squeeze going on due to input pricing. They don't really talk about the whole area of concern about sales. As a matter of fact, sales have been pretty good, right?
They've been okay. I wouldn't say they've been okay. I mean,
they're not growing fast, but they're not dropping. They've been on.
Well, in some areas. I mean, banks, we're not seeing any growth at all.
Oh, forget banks. Let's just take the banks and put them into...
Big part of the S&P 500, though.
Let's put all the banks in a Greek island somewhere.
Okay, deal. Without the banks.
Okay, without the banks. As a matter of fact, when I look at the numbers, when I do my reports, I always do the S&P X financials, just to let you know.
Anything X scares me.
Yeah, like our ex-wives, right?
that's absolutely accurate. Go ahead. I go with your point right away. Yeah,
so the thing is that I think that companies are slashing employees, and one of the things that we get hung up on here a lot, and I'm not trying to make excuses, and I'm not putting a silver lining on this by any means, you know me. But I think one of the things we get hung up is we look at the U.S. economics as the driver for U.S. stocks, when in fact U.S. stocks, for the most part, not everyone, are globally based from a revenue standpoint, from a revenue input standpoint. And at the same time, when you look at these countries, even though their stock markets are in hell, and India, China, Brazil, because they're trying to clamp down, but you look at Germany where the jobs are growing and all, a little bit of a rollover on their industrial production. The rest of Europe, you can also put in an island in Greece. But when you look at what's going on and what's being bought, the Tiffany's, the Coaches, you know, the major players that are the high-end products on retail, they're surprising everybody. And on top of that, the continuation for many of the tech companies on building infrastructure for the enhancement of these companies to actually cut payrolls, you know, a la Salesforce. I think there is some benefit to the bottom line of companies short term. Now, if we continue seeing a move like we saw that last time where we really had layoffs, I mean, you know, big, it got negative, it got ugly, that's a problem. But, you know, a little bit of layoffs here and there and stabilizing the current rate of unemployment at this level is awful for anybody that doesn't have a job. It's awful for confidence, and it's awful for consumption or retail sales in the U.S. based on U.S. retail sales. That's why Walmart and Target are having such problems. But when you look at those companies that are external, look at a Chipotle, McDonald's, food companies, look at the major players that are expanding around the world from either jewelry or clothing lines, I mean, they're doing all right.
They're doing okay, but even looking at, let's look at a different scenario here. It's almost to the point where we're looking at a number in the S&P 500 earnings. The total earnings for the S&P 500 is 102.
Yes.
Now, to put based on Thomson Reuters. Now, to put that in perspective, it's never been over 100 in the history of the markets, right? But yet we have record deficits. We have, you know, this terrible economic data. Yet these earnings, you know, filtering macro to the bottom line and trying to separate these two things between the macro and corporations. But I believe that a lot of these companies are going to have to cut just to meet their inflated earnings estimates. Now, if we believe that in 2012, these companies are going to be able to earn $102. Remember, this $102 is a forward-looking estimate where we were looking at an economy that was supposed to grow 4% right now. Now it looks like it's growing 2%. Keep that in mind, right? And we're also looking at China, India. You mentioned the global picture. And those countries are doing everything they can to slow. Who knows what's going on in Europe right now, because they're bailing out everybody. I mean, you look at Germany and France are okay. Everybody else looks terrible out there, most for the part. But you're looking at, if we see just, right, based on that $102 number, we're looking at earnings trading at 13 times forward earnings. Very cheap, right? Very cheap based on historical standards. Now, if you're looking at a 10% decline in those earnings to $90, just say around $90, 10, 11% decline, now the S&P is not really that cheap anymore, because now you're looking at the S&P trading at 15 times earnings with an economy growing at 2%. You know, we're not expensive, but we're not as cheap as everybody thinks out there. I just believe that it's going to be very difficult for us to meet that 102 number. And if we do meet that 102 number, you're right. It's going to be because all the cuts that they're doing, but that's going to filter in down the road. I mean, just take it into simple terms. When you walk into a store, you have four people in a store. If it's an Abercrombie and Fitch, whatever it is, you walk in, you have four people, one at the counter. If you're cutting those employees, it's going to be a worse experience for the customer, to the point where you're going to get worse customer service. People who have ever called Comcast know exactly what I'm talking about. It's going to get to the point where you're going to lose business if you don't have enough people running the shop. And it's going to be interesting to see this translation, because to make that $102 in earnings for S&P 500 companies, which is an optimistic expectation, if they meet it, they're going to have to cut employees drastically. They're going to have to cut costs drastically, because I'm not seeing that top line growth. It's growing, but not as much. I mean, like I mentioned, the bank stocks, they're growing revenues at 2%, yet they're supposed to grow earnings by 35%. I just can't see it. That's a scenario for a lot of different sectors, and I really don't see it again. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, I hear you. So, you know, did we talk about this? Have we talked about the end of the world video?
No, we haven't talked about the end of the world video.
Because it's kind of like, I think it's more popular than Dance Dance Revolution.
I think it's more popular than Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the things that I have to take a little bit, you know, I've been on the silver short bandwagon, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been like, yee-haw, short silver. You know, as a matter of fact, I have one of my posts has a little embedded video of the Lone Ranger, hi-ho, silver, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, because I get into it a little bit. So, whatever time it was, we were talking about shorting, and then we went a little bit long, then we shorted, then we got out, and then about a week and a half ago, we said it's time to short again. And frankly, I think that I was a little surprised at the recent move down, considering the fact the dollar has been weakening and the fact that there's still a lot of concern out there. I mean, silver got obliterated the last few days.
It's got obliterated. I mean, we have to take things in perspective. I mean, silver used to trade under $20 an ounce for most of its history.
Yeah, and a pretzel was a nickel. All right, so.
No, but it's trading in a $20 range in the past couple of months. So, right. I mean, we have to put in perspective where it was at 50. It's still very, very high at where is it, 35-ish now.
Yep,
but,
yep.
I mean, the move from 30 to 50 was just insane, and it's come back. And credit to you that you actually went out there, because a lot of people went out there at 35 and said the short silver, and, you really nailed it at the top there. So, it's just been up so much, so now it's at $35.
Yeah, and I think that, by the way, the play is, although it's more expensive, I think that one of the things that people got sucked into with silver, it was the poor man's gold. I mean, what I'm saying about that is not derogatory or anything, but the fact is that it was, a cheap way to play the metal market. And mm-hmm. I think people got really sideswiped by that. But gold is definitely a play for inflation and for sovereign debt concerns, et cetera. Now, the end of the world video, this is a thing that was put together by Porter Stansberry, that the reason why I bring this up is because sometimes you hear about things in the most bizarre places and from people that you wouldn't expect. And I got all of a sudden these emails, and one night I'm at my house with a bunch of friends, and they said, have you seen this video? I'm like, what? What? You know, the end of the world 2012 or whatever exactly called. And Porter Stansberry puts together a pretty compelling piece on basically the end of the dollar as we know it, and the need to get the heck out of the dollar into anything else, and in particular gold and precious metals and things of that nature, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. It's pretty scary. It's pretty to the point. It's pretty much, we'll send it, let's put it this way. My father-in-law came in and started wanting to buy silver and things. Now, I know, you don't have to go through all this. I don't know if you even know this, but, you work for Stansberry & Associates. Porter Stansberry is the Stansberry in that. What is he still advocating silver, or what's the story with that?
Yeah, he loves silver. He loves gold. And the scary thing about that video is he probably provides 100 facts mm-hmm. in there where the government cannot pay off its debts. I mean, it's just facts that eventually, like we're talking about QE2, QE3, and saying that, okay, we're going to need a QE3. Otherwise, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. This economy's not going to grow. So, yeah, I mean, we can get a QE3, QE4, QE5. Eventually, we have to pay. Like right now, the politicians, everyone, based on the amount of subscribers we've got, from the End of America video, which is saying, hey, you know, we're going to see a destruction of the dollar. The whole entire world is really, really aware of what's going on. Like, right. We never really believe, like, you never realize how many subscribers we got from this. It's incredible. But it's just a point that people are really concerned. Like, when is enough is enough? So Porter just provides ways of how to protect yourself if it does happen, if the dollar isn't the reserve currency anymore. And people are very concerned about it. And what's funny about the video is, there's a long video and there's a subscription afterwards, and you can purchase this newsletter. It's up to you. But the thing is, you get a money back guarantee if you don't want to purchase it, and nobody's asking for their money back. So it's not, you know, people look at the video, they're like, oh my God, I want to subscribe to this because I want to see what else. And then they're reading and saying, wow, you know what? And it's just a way for people, especially retirees out there, to really be aware of this trend and protect themselves in case that does happen. And will it happen? Maybe, maybe not. That's anyone's opinion. But according to Porter, he believes that is the future of the economy, where we're going to see a destruction of the dollar based on the amount of debt that we have that we can't even pay off, that we can barely pay off the interest right now. So that's how he feels.
Let me ask you this in closing. One of the things you and I have talked about is this whole disaster in the area of the reverse mergers and the shoe-ins by Chinese companies in the U.S., and a lot of them are being taken off the exchange. As a matter of fact, a trend recently has been for some companies, big companies, reputable companies, to actually delist because they want to get away from the costs of Sarbanes-Oxley, et cetera. This is different. The recent situation with like a Long Top Financial or a Heat, or I mean,
even Yahoo.
Yeah, even Yahoo with the Alibaba situation, right? What's the story with regard to the real long-term nature of this? I mean, you got this site called Muddy Waters that keeps on muddying up the water with concern over irregularities. I mean, they just, you know, last couple of days they banged stocks down 25% with some commentary. What is the thought? Are you going to just stay away from these and just say, you know what, I'm not getting near this China green agriculture. I'm just not doing this now.
Yeah, and to be fair, I've always given ideas on your show, and about 6 months ago, I've gave a couple of Chinese ideas, and this was they did very well at the beginning, and a lot of them have gotten crushed. So I'm going to take responsibility for that. I think it's important. A lot of people don't take responsibility for their losers. I do, and even some of those stocks have come down because I visited China, and I'm able to. And one of the ways that I try to protect myself is, one, I wanted to make sure that some of these companies were audited by the Big Four, which they were. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter. I went to these properties to visit them to make sure they were real, shook the CEO's hands, the CFO's hands, visited their properties, and also made sure that they had large stakes in the company, which they did. But now today, you're seeing a lot of these companies come out and say, well, there's behind-the-scenes deals, and so there has to be some kind of regulation, more regulation, because if there's not, it's very difficult to really go, especially in the small cap area, because it's so easy to take down because there's no institutional ownership. So what's frustrating to me is the companies that I went to go visit and even visit their properties, when I see, I mean, you have Citron, you have Muddy Waters, who I think are credible short sellers in there, but you have a lot of other guys where they won't even disclose their name of their firm for some reason, and saying that these properties don't exist, properties that I stood on. And it's very frustrating when they could bring a stock down 20% based on what they write, that they don't even give their name. So in this industry right now, you're going to see incredible value. One of the companies I mentioned was Yongyi International, fertilizer play that has come down and was, you know, a lot of short sellers have written a ton of negative news. And just a couple of weeks ago, the stock jumped 30% because I think it was Morgan Stanley, and gave him a fusion and say, okay, this is all bull. So you're going to see that come in. You're also going to see a lot of companies, even Puda Cole, the CEO, came out and said, all right, I'm buying the company myself for $12. So you're going to see a lot of things come out where a lot of negative news and this stuff's coming down. But you have to be careful. You need more regulation. When you're seeing large caps, like you said, you know, Long Top and you're seeing Yahoo really come out, and you're seeing the CEOs behind those Chinese units really going behind the scenes and doing deals that nobody knows about. It's not listed on the SEC or the books. You have to really be careful in this industry.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, Frank Curzio, of course, at Stansberry Associates. You can find out more about him and his wonderful podcast, the SNA podcast. And I think that we want to kind of follow up, I think, in a couple of weeks. I want to see what is going to happen. Do you think that this – I guess in closing, here's the question. Do you think that this is a linear economic process where we're going to see a continuation of degrading economic numbers, or is this something that's going to be kind of aligned to a drop due to an offset of the time with the Japanese situation, or is this just, you know, kind of until a lot of the things resolve between MENA, Europe, China, and our own disgusting congressional bantering and whatever's going on, is this going to be continuing to slow down?
You know what? I think we're going to see it continue to slow down, but don't try to jump the gun. Let's wait till we see more positive economic data. Let's see if every economist is right that Japanese, you know, it's a one-time thing. It's going to get back on track. Let's see. We're going to see that filtering in economic data. We saw the negative economic data, and you had a couple of weeks to sell stocks before we've seen this in May. We're probably going to see upticks in some data, and yes, the stock market will move up, but let's get that foundation under us before you go in there and buy. Don't just guess, because it's very difficult to tell where the market's heading. But the data will show us the way, and I think you'll be able to buy stocks and get in if we do see an uptick in economic data.
Yeah, I hear you. Frank Curzio, the best in the world. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, bud. My pleasure.
Right, bye-bye. All right, back by popular demand, we just talked with Frank, one of the favorites of the listeners, and another favorite, Terry Bedford of Bedford & Associates. He does a variety of things like coaching and writing and teaching, and he does some personal trading too. But what Terry is really good about and what he's really good at measuring and understanding is everything about, I guess, directional momentum and also things like support points and where to hedge and where not to. So I thought it would be a great time, with the market being wonky at best, to bring back Terry. So Terry, how are you? It's been a while, my friend. How is it going?
I'm doing well.
Good.
It has been a while, but glad to be back.
Good. Listen, I have so many things to talk to you about. Let's start out with, you know, what happened the last few weeks. So, you know, the market has been resilient over the last, let's just say this year. And you could throw at it the whole idea of, you know, a breakdown in the area of, you know, sovereign issues and the Japanese earthquake. All the economists are like, it's not a problem, it's not a problem. And the market plods along. Earnings come in good, all this nice stuff directionally. Okay. Get a couple little breakdowns, but it's very technically driven. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely, I would. Yeah. Yes.
So it's very technically driven, the market, which means, by the way, that it respects technical levels, 200-day moving averages or 100-day EMA or whatever it fits to. Let's put it that way. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
we can go backwards and fit it backwards, right? So
it's the best kind of trading.
Right. Exactly. After the fact. So tell me, what is it that is going to, with all the things now with the bad news about the economics, we saw last week, we saw the NFP number that was terrible, putrid, awful. And, you know, what is it, in your opinion, that is going to be the, we'll make it very simple, the make it or break it for markets to continue either down or to stabilize or move higher at this point?
Well, I've said this to you before, but I honestly feel badly for bears, because everything that they say about sovereign debt, Asia slowing, no employment growth in the U.S., that's all right. They're correct about everything.
Right.
But the reason they can't get the market to go down is because people believe they have this Bernanke put.
Yeah.
So as long as the Fed's in the corner of the bulls, it's going to be tough to get the market to go down. And even though we've had what I would call a technical break here because the moving averages have been broken, I suspect it's still going to be tough to get the market to go down over the next few weeks. And, you know, to be honest, the bad data we're getting out supports the idea that they're going to do quantitative easing 3. So
I mean, this is, you know, even rock the Rocky series, you know, was limited to the amount of replays they could do on this. I mean, you know, seriously, do you think that there is a political will, or there's an appetite, or there's even the, I mean, there's been discussion that a QE3 would be really bad for the markets because it would then disqualify and discredit QE2.
Yeah, but they said that about QE2 disqualifying and discrediting QE1. You know, I think it's, as long as, you know, there's a movie with Willem Dafoe. What is that? To Live and Die in L.A., and the guy says to Willem Dafoe, who's counterfeiting money, and he says, "You be a printer, and you have ink. Go print some money." And that's what they're going to do. They're going to keep doing that forever. I don't see them stopping that at all until the economy's better. So
it seems to me. I'm having a hard time with this. I mean, I get the point. I understand it. Yep. I understand also that, you know, this is now a political and a personal challenge to Bernanke, to make sure that the, you know, depression doesn't repeat and blah, 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 and he doesn't make the mistakes and DDD and all this good stuff. And then also we're in a presidential election year, or cycle, I should say, in the back end of this. And obviously there's a lot of desire for that. But at the same time, you got Moody's downgrading or talking about downgrading the U.S. if they don't get their debt ceiling in order. And how much QE is it going to take at this point? Instead of, I mean, wouldn't it be better just to devalue the dollar? I mean, that's what they're doing. and give like 20 grand to each person in the country.
Well, they're doing that anyway. They're just, it's two different ways to skin a cat. But the thing is, what's going to drive the markets? And I think that bears are missing the calculus. The calculus is that bulls have a Bernanke put.
Yeah.
And as long as they have that put, they're going to buy all the dips. All the dips are going to be shallow. And, I feel sorry for bears because they're right about everything. And one day all this is going to end badly. It always does. But I don't think the market goes down until people believe that the Federal Reserve is going to fail to inflate the economy. When they believe that, then I don't think there's anything they can help the market. It doesn't matter how much money they print then.
Right. Now, when has there been a time? Well, you can get in crisis times and all that, but the Fed's always been there to help out, right?
Yep.
So the issue is really more like the confidence of whether the Fed has the ability to help out. That's the issue, right?
That's right.
Yeah, it's all
right.
Confidence.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it exactly. As soon as people believe the Federal Reserve is going to fail or likely to fail, it's over. The market's going to collapse, and you're going to have a repeat of what I call the bad old days of 2008, 2009. You're just going to have the market going down 500 or 600 Dow points every day. But we're not at that stage. And it wouldn't take more than Ben Bernanke on the weekend saying, we're considering QE3 for the market to go up 200 points on Monday or next week.
So, you know, 200 points on the S&P.
No, I'm talking about 200 Dow points.
Oh, that would be easy. I would think 500 points, to be honest with you, because now it's like a heroin addict right now trying to come off of this stuff, and I think there's a lot of question. I know that seems like a good answer, Terry, and I know that I just don't want to hang my hat on that.
I know there's a butt coming.
No, I just don't want to hang my hat on that. I guess that's the point. I mean, I think that it's reckless and immoral, and I think it's a bad investment thesis to hang your hat on QE3. I'll be all there on QE2. I'm with you on this because it's there, and I'll also be there when we're talking about earnings. I'll be there when we talk about technicals. But until at least we get a hint of the QE3 and the size, the scope, what it is, I just don't want to hang my portfolio, my personal assets on these lunatics.
Well, I agree. I'm not saying that you should go out and buy stocks because it's QE3 coming or it's going to be successful or anything like that. I'm saying that if you're a bear, you got to be careful about being short because there is the potential for you to get blown up.
There is. It's impossible to be short. Let me tell you something. Yeah. The only way you can be short, if you want to be short, you have two choices. Either, and it doesn't matter the name, it can be the worst name in the world. If you want to be short on a particular particular issue, okay, because it's, I don't know, overvalued, because the company's going through a major issue, I don't know, whatever it is, you have to have the mindset, I think, that you go short and then you get the hell out when you make some money.
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah. You have to trade.
You know?
But you have to do that being long as well. I mean, it's been a terrible market to just buy and hold.
Right.
For years, right?
Yep, it has been. And that's something we always talk about. And one of the things that we've been doing lately, I'll tell you a little bit what we're doing, is that, we have core positions that we really like, and that changes, and we may hate them the next day, but I'm just in theory. And then we're just wrapping them with some hedges around them, and we're using a pretty significant hedge. If we're wrong on the hedge, we rip it off real quick, utilizing some very important technical points, like you said, because you know that it's going to go the other way. And then, keep the stocks that you have. And this is something you and I talked about. You talked about using some options on this. So I have a question for you. If you were to use a VIX option, by the way, even with this down movement, the VIX is nowhere.
I know.
You know, so there's no fear, there's no complacency. And I don't know if that's right or wrong, but it's what it is. But if you were to use a VIX option, let's say, or another option, and to hedge your portfolio, and to hedge it cleanly. The problem is that let's say you use, and you figure this out, a 2% position on your whole portfolio.
Right.
Of an option, which is a big option, by the way, right? You know?
Yeah, it would be.
But the problem is that you have to then get more than 2% to even break even on the upside. Right?
Yep, that's
so,
right.
So, what is the length of time that usually would go out? Is it a 2.5-3 month period?
Yeah, I'd be 3 months.
Right.
So I want to be a quarter just to give myself a little bit of breathing room. But it's tough to even do that. It's just you're paying a huge premium in many cases. Not so much on the VIX. If you buy options on the VIX, you're not paying premiums at all. But I don't know. It's just tough to be short. It's tough to hedge too. It's just a market where you sort of have to have your positions. And what I've been doing is just closing them. I have stop levels; they get stopped out, and I'm
well. The problem with that, Terry, also is that, you know, the problem you have with that is then getting back into them, and then you got transaction fees. Maybe I'm just saying for people, you know, it's just as tough that way, and that's why we've kind of gone a little bit to say, okay, you know, we're gonna have a little bit greater stop losses on them, and hedge it out if appropriate. But you know, I'll give you an example of something that we've done for clients, and I'll get your opinion on this. So we've been kind of dabbling in the area of silver. Okay. About right before the silver broke down, I don't know if you know, we talked about this maybe. Right before the silver broke down, I was like, you know what? Short. Go short.
Yep.
And it was a, you know, kind of a, I don't want to call it a gutsy call, but it was a little bit of a little premature by 4 or 5 days, but I'll go with that.
That was a great call.
Yeah. And it went down. Now, the problem, though, is that now playing silver, we like to use the inverse 2x. It just, it tracks relatively well during the day, maybe not the overnight, but, you know, during the day, it tracks really well. The problem, though, is it moves really quickly. Silver moves very quickly. On Friday, it was down overnight about 2.7%, and it moved up from the overnight session from about 8:30 to about 9:30, about 1.5%. That's a big move on a commodity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, that's a hard thing to play, but, you know, it's something that's very interesting because it has this knack of cracking midday or midnight.
Yeah.
You know, so what is it that you think are some of the, you know, the things that are really good tradable positions right now? I mean, what are you looking at? What are you focusing on?
Well, it's funny because what I've found is that a lot of the consumer discretionary sectors just look terrible. And I don't know if people are betting that there's going to be a significant slowdown in the economy or what, but when I look at the shoes, Deckers and Nike, and even apparel like Ralph Lauren, they just look horrific. Mm-hmm. And they look like shorts. And I would short those. I'd also short things like Whirlpool. I think that looks terrible. And it's funny because I'm sort of a closet bull. Even though we've got some technical breaks in the market, I like to look for things that are going up. But I'm not finding a lot of stocks that look super attractive. Now, here for the last 10 minutes, I've been telling you it's tough to be a bear and to short things, but the things that I find that look like trades are shorts. You know, they're Nike, Deck, Ralph Lauren, Whirlpool.
Well, let me talk to you about that because that's very interesting that you mentioned that because I'll give you an example. Again, you know, Deckers is one of those, as I call it, one of the loved stocks. They love it.
Yeah.
And they have a cult following, you know, as does Netflix / Salesforce / Chipotle. I can name the name. You know the names.
Yeah.
The problem, though, is once you get a wind of the right direction, even though they're not selling, they don't care. They just buy. They put the buy program on.
That's right.
And, you know, I agree with you on Deckers, by the way, and shoes. But have you looked at the longer-term trend of shoe companies?
Yeah, I know.
First of all, it's mind-boggling.
It's straight up.
Wait a minute. And the only thing we could figure is that everybody has, well, not everybody, I shouldn't say that. Many people have 2 feet, okay? And you wear out shoes, and around the world you need shoes, and people like their shoes, and they just, I mean, it's almost like a necessity at this point. I mean, it is a necessity, but it's ridiculous.
It's true. But it's the big theme that the world is becoming more homogenous. You know, people are eating meat, right? So you've got you can't be underinvested in grain because they use grain to feed cattle and, you know, all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I agree with that. I'm just saying I look at the charts. So I'm looking at dailies, not so much weekly. So the weeklies are still pretty bullish for most of the shoe stocks. Mm-hmm. But I look at dailies. They just look horrific.
Yeah, I agree with you, by the way, totally about this. And, you know, there's been some stocks that we would love to short. For example, there's a company named Joseph A. Banks.
Yes.
Men's Warehouse. I mean, they've gone through a couple of choppy sessions there and all that. But you have to wonder, okay, let's think about this. First of all, Joseph Banks, you buy a shirt and you get like 27 suits for free. Right or wrong? You know what I'm saying? Plus a pair of shoes and a tie. I'm like, you're paying $3 and you got like an entire wardrobe. That's first of all. Second of all, the price of cotton has gone up dramatically. And I am certain that they don't have a particular cotton farm that's of their own. And they have to pay a lot more for that. Third, the amount of people that are shopping, because they already got their 32 suits last year, okay? How many people are shopping? So, but you don't want to get near these things, because I don't know if you've ever seen, I mean, this thing moves.
Yeah.
And earnings come out last week or so, and the stock created by like 13 or 14%. But this is what we're seeing. I mean, you know, you would think that we all knew about Research in Motion 2 years ago, of what an awful product they had, what the problems they have. The stock was resilient because people just said, oh, I have to own it. I have to own it. Yeah. You know, you look at, and I'll give you another example. When you look at companies like HP,
yes,
as an example, and, you know, they're a good company. Nothing, stock hasn't been performing, but it's a good company. It's good products. But, you know, when you start hearing all these players on TV talking about it's a great value, it's really cheap. What does that say to you?
HP is a great value and really cheap.
That's what they say. I'm telling you, that's what they say. I've heard it 100 times.
They make crummy products. And I don't know why. Well, I know why people buy HP products. They buy them because there's no choice. You want to buy a printer.
Right. You buy HP.
You don't have a choice.
Right.
But it's a lousy printer. You know. So, but, you know. I think that there's sort of a mindset that people just, they get these stocks stuck in their mind. Those are stocks you've got to buy. You know, people say Microsoft. You got to buy Microsoft. It hasn't gone anywhere for 12 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got to buy it. It's great value.
But it's very safe.
It's safe if you don't want to earn anything. Right, exactly. You don't want any rate of return. Right.
I got a stock. It's been doing fine. It hasn't moved through all of this. Yeah. Through all of what? Through all the last decade.
Yeah, that's right.
So what else? I mean, so the shorts we're looking at Whirlpool. That's good because the consumer durables. And I give you that on retail. By the way, a lot of people are short the retail. And when you look at the retail and you look at technology, what really troubles me, by the way, is those are usually the first in and the first out.
Yep.
Would you agree?
I agree. I would agree with that, yes.
Yeah. So you have the retail, which was the first to roll over. And by the way, some retail looks still pretty strong. Some of the higher end retail.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've been trying to actually buy a Fossil.
Oh, we have
to buy it on the setup. But you know, that looks like it's going straight up. I have no idea why.
It's that because they came out with great earnings that were out of control.
Oh yeah, the earnings were great, but I have no idea how they're making so much money. But
but Terry, do you care, or are you just looking for a chart pattern?
No, I don't care. I don't care.
Right.
They can That's be. What I'm trying to buy. I just have no idea why they're going up.
They're, in my opinion, because we own that stock, by the way. And we've owned it before the earnings. We cut back half the position after the earnings, and it's been trailing off a little bit. I will tell you that the expansion of their stores is dramatic. The particular products they have, don't forget, they don't just make those middle of the range priced watches. They own like Michelle, you know Michelle? They own all these different high-end brands. And the high-end brands are selling like crazy internationally because there has been an amazing amount of wealth building throughout the emerging markets. And they're spending money like we did a few years ago, actually. You know?
The center of the world has moved.
Yes, it has. So you have, that's why Tiffany came out with those great earnings. Fossil came out. It's hard to imagine. I get it. I do.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine how, McDonald's has been at an all-time high for whatever with the cost of food input prices and all. But, you know, it's a good company. I would say, though, you know, if the markets roll, it's going to roll with it.
Yeah. I mean, but didn't we talk last time about Chipotle, and you were saying how the food prices were going to impact the margins, and that's why I should avoid it. But it's the same thing. Isn't that the same expansion of stores idea? That's what the real driver is?
Well, the difference was that it was all about the food, and the food being at an all-time high. We actually shorted it. We covered it, made about 10 points on it, and then it just came right back after that. We went long the next earnings because we figured they were going to actually increase their prices, and the thing just like kind of did nothing. They went down. Now it's at, you know, all the way. You know, we cut out of it very quickly because it just was starting to curl down, and it just really wasn't playing right. Markets at that point weren't good, and now it's kind of moved back up. So, yes, I mean, I think it is, but the question is you know, looking back on it, I think the other thing I've mentioned to you is Tempur-Pedic.
Yeah. Yep.
Who the heck is buying all those mattresses? You know what I mean?
But I'm told it's a great product.
It may be, but I mean, have you seen that chart?
Yeah, I have seen it.
It's ridiculous. Come on.
Yeah, I know. Parabolic advances bring parabolic declines. The question is when.
Yeah. This thing just keeps on just nibbling higher and nibbling higher. Yeah. I mean, so I agree with you. I mean, look what happened to a company like, was it TravelZoo a few weeks ago? Went up like 35%, then it came down 3 days later, 35%.
Yeah.
You know, on a short squeeze.
That one's crazy, though. That's not real.
So when you try to look for these setups you mentioned, like on Fossil, so everybody understands, what would be a setup that you'd be looking for?
Well, I'm looking for, you know, they're basically there are continuation patterns and there are reversal patterns. And I don't want to, you know, make your viewers or listeners' eyes dry out or anything, but a reversal pattern would be like what a technician would call a head and shoulders bottom. So you have a long decline, and then you have a stock basing. It makes what looks like a head and shoulders upside down, breaks out through what would be the neckline, and then you have a breakout and it goes up. Something like Fossil would be the other end of the spectrum, and that's a stock that's in a strong bullish trend, and I'm looking for a flag. So I want to have a big move up. I want to have it consolidate and go sideways slightly lower on decreased volume, and then I have another breakout and it starts the next leg up. So I'm looking for that flag set up on Fossil right now to buy it.
Well, you know, we just picked up I don't know if you'd consider this flag or a pennant, but take a look at, this is one of I like when it comes across and then smacks into the 10-week line.
Yep.
If you look at Mercado Libre, Meli, M-E-L-I, on a weekly chart, it came up like that, and it consolidated slightly lower on mixed volume, I would say, and then it hit and then touched and tested its 10-week, and then boop, right up.
Yeah.
It just started.
Yeah, that's a good-looking chart.
Isn't that good? That's my favorite chart.
Yeah, I hadn't even seen that one.
Ah, there you go. Meli. And you know who they are, right? What they do? They're the eBay of Latin America?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, good company. Solid company, too.
Hmm. So they don't have the same issues that eBay has with... eBay has Kijiji, but isn't that just all of the classifieds going to free?
But I think this is... here it is. I mean, with Craigslist and all that.
Yeah.
You know, down there they have, Raul's List. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that's the case. It's also a lot of different things they do than eBay. It's not exactly an eBay. I mean, but there's a lot of different things that they do with regard to selling things online, and also people could do it. It's a much different audience there, so they're really utilizing the heck out of it. So I don't think the models are actually anything different. I'll share another one with you. This is stock that we like from a fundamental standpoint. Mm-hmm. And something we've owned and actually just broke out on Friday again. It's GT Solar, S-O-L-R. Now, it's a smaller company, and they're in the solar business. Already, I'm like, I don't want to talk about it, all right? I don't want to talk about a for-profit school. I don't want to talk about a solar, okay?
Right.
But we've actually just recently owned both of them. We've owned actually Bridgeport up until a couple of days ago, and we sold it as that major breakout of it that I think was about a 13% move higher. And then it started to trail back because the shorts got in there and we pulled it because we're not waiting around to see how things go right now.
Right. You know?
So, and I think, by the way, that's a lesson for everybody. Wouldn't you agree right now in this market environment? If you make a few bucks, move on.
Yeah. I always agree with that strategy. No problem taking profits.
So solar, it's about a three-year-old company, but different than a regular solar company that kind of sells the whole solar thing and all that. They make the parts, they're like the AMAT of the solar industry. AMAT, right? So where they make the machines that make the processors.
Yeah.
They make the furnaces for LED, the sapphire furnaces. They make the machines that make the sapphire and the photovoltaic and all this stuff, okay? And they've been getting ridiculous amounts of orders in, and their backlog is ridiculous, okay? So I listened into the conference call a few weeks ago. I like what I heard. The stock moves up nicely, and then, of course, like every other solar, after the earnings, it kind of just trails off, okay?
Right.
We sell it after the nice pop up because we held it for a little while. It didn't get past the point that we wanted to, that we thought it should. And then we buy it back a couple of weeks ago. And then on Friday, there's an announcement of the largest order they've ever received, ever. About a $440 million order from China. Now, China also announced last week that they are going to be doubling their solar energy use like ASAP.
Right.
Okay. So you combine that with an order from a major Chinese solar company. And the fact is that 440 is, I think the last one that was the biggest was like 300. And that's the backlog, and the stock really moved up, about, I don't know, 13 or 14% on Friday. Wow. And but if you look at that, you have a little higher to clear, this little about the 14 and change level, but then you're going to be clearing all the way back to the left from its IPO closing prices.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I always like to see that.
That's a good looking chart. I hadn't seen that one either. That's actually a good story too. It's always nice to own the picks and axes.
Exactly.
You know, Rush. You want to own the guys that are making the shovels,
I want to own Levi's, right? Not work the fields.
That's right.
What other things would actually, what would turn you, we know that you have a bullish tendency, which is fine, just going long, that means.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean
yeah.
you're staying there. But what would be the case that would turn you bearish, aside from maybe just Bernanke saying, all right, you know what, I'm retiring?
Well, I think the thing is, I think if we get too many more closes below the 50-day moving average on the S&P, I think that's just going to be a negative. I don't think he can overcome that. So we're down below the 50-day rate now, and I think that you could make a realistic case that bulls would concede a decline into the 1250 area. That would put them back around the 200-day, and I think that you could look forward to that. But even then, that wouldn't be the end of the world. You know, the S&P has been in an uptrend since the 2009 lows. If you just draw a line through the trend line or a trend line through the lows, you come in at around 1244 on the S&P. So you can make a case that if we stay too many more days here below the 50-day, you're going to get a decline back into that 1240, 1250 area.
Yeah, and if you break the 100, which has been, you got to look at both the EMAs and the SMAs, but the 100 has been kind of this bouncy point here, and we're close to one. We have these algorithms that we put together for support and resistance. You may have seen those.
Yeah, I've seen those. You send them to me.
Yeah, and it's getting really, really close, and it's also kind of nice to see some of the bouncing points have been very accurate with those, but not always. I mean, it doesn't always work like that. It just gives you a guideline. But I agree with you with that. The other problem is, right, that the S&P starts sloping. I know you're big into the slopes.
That's right.
And I don't mean skiing, but tell me about that.
Yeah. When you get the averages rolling over and pointing down, they become pretty formidable resistance. So when they start turning down like they are right now, then you got trouble. So you've got to get back in that 1330 range just to sort of keep the averages from rolling over too much.
Right.
So I'd want to see the market improve here pretty quickly. In the next week or two, you want to see the market back in the 1330 range. If not, then you're going to get 1250.
And obviously, I think we're both probably thinking this. What in the world would make that happen? Would it be Greece is all of a sudden fixed? Well, we know, by the way, everybody knows whatever happens with Greece is total BS. We know that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It doesn't matter. We'll play along anyway with a big smile.
That's right.
You know?
Right.
So they'll fix something, and the market will go up. And then hopefully there's no other earthquakes and things like that at all, obviously. And but then we're going to have, I think what you're going to see is you're going to see economic downgrades of the economy because of the jobs number. And I think that we're setting up, I think it's a very interesting time, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We're setting up, we're in between earnings season. So we have no real vision of what's going to be happening in right now. And we don't know what's going to be flowing over from Japan that may have changed. And we're also kind of coming to the end of quote-unquote QE2, and who knows if the sequel is going to be born.
Right.
And then on top of it, we have all this bad economic news, not only from here, by the way. If you look around the world, China's PMI is slowing down. Their manufacturing is slowing down. Japan's a disaster. Although nobody cares about Japan being the worst disaster in the world. They just keep buying the stock market.
That's right.
Because
it's a disaster forever.
Yeah, because they just – that's what we do. We're supposed to buy the stock market because, you know.
Because they make cool stuff?
I don't know. Not anymore. I don't really know. and then you have the the European situation, and hopefully not oil. I mean, I'm hoping we see oil knocked down pretty good. That would be a catalyst, in my opinion. Although it would kind of mess people up that are traders.
I think if oil went down, I think that's sort of the tail wagging the dog. I think the market goes down and oil goes down. I think that's part of the risk trade, right? So,
right.
I think if people are anxious about risk, then they take off that stuff.
Have you actually bought one of those little buttons, the risk on, risk off buttons? Can you actually, how does that work? Does that hook up to your computer and you just have like a thing that you push risk on, everything goes on, and then you risk off, you just take it off?
You know, I know you're saying that in jest, but that's pretty much the way it is.
I understand.
Literally, guys wake up the next day and then risk on trade, and you got all the copper stocks going straight up.
Yeah.
And they keep going straight up for weeks. Then the risk is off and they all go down.
Yeah, well, you know, usually you'd have to have that actually attached to your computer in the old days with a wire. Now there's an app that they make that. Yeah, you could do it on the road.
There's an app for that, right?
The risk on and risk off app. Terry Bedford, you're always a pleasure to talk to. I'll make sure to put all the information about how to get in touch with you and see your fine work and your different services you offer over at Bedford & Associates. And we'll keep in touch.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for joining me. Good luck.
Hey, thanks.
Bye-bye. Well, that's going to wrap it up for today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Make sure to check out DH Unplugged. We always have a lot of fun on that show. That's on Wednesdays each and every week, myself and John C. Dvorak. And of course, if you want any information on maybe how to, you know, really understand the markets a little bit better and you want, go check out my book over at Amazon, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. Until the next time, we'll speak soon. Have a great week. Have a safe week. Be watching for trend reversals this week and stay on your toes. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.